Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hello, 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 my wonderful audience. I've come back from a fabulous weekend with Pam Popper, the conference we co-sponsored in Ohio, Columbus, and we'll be doing that, you know, continually for the indefinite future, I hope. Pam does most of the work, but I get the honor of co-sponsoring and presenting. And we're coming out now with a series of videos that I'll be giving you more information about soon. One of them is a consumer video on training on psychiatric drug withdrawal. It's shorter than our giant course. It's mostly intended for people who want in-depth information, not necessarily just professionals, but in-depth information and want to be communicating with a psychiatrist while taking the course. And then there's going to be another course on that we're starting in the next month on how to help people. And it begins part one, how to help yourself, and part two, how to help others. A lot of exciting stuff. You can go to Pam Popper's website and look it up. But you can also get directly in touch with Pam. And you can do that right now by go down to the conference information that's on the ribbon across the bottom of my website toward the bottom. And you can just pop up that information and you can give Pam an email or a call about the courses. She's just happy to talk to people about them. But we'll be putting all this together a little more coherently for you, but just doing wonderful work there. Many of you know that Peter Goetze is under attack, and I've set up a separate page on my website for Peter Goetze, and now we have the finalized arrangements to do a full day honoring and conference on Peter Goetze in his hometown, supporting him and supporting freedom, scientific freedom, supporting scientific freedom. We'll be doing it in Copenhagen, Denmark in early March next year. So we'll be telling you more about that. I just want to say there's just a lot going on out there in the world. You can keep up with the attack on Peter Goetze by going to our website and look down the left side of the introductory columns on on the breaking news, on important events and stuff that's atop my website, and take a look at Peter Goetze's website. So there's lots of terrific things going on here. Don't forget my YouTube, by the way, which is just got such great stuff on it, including the speech I gave a month ago on love and therapy. I gave it to a Christian group, to several hundred people in Denver who are counselors who specialize in helping Christians through the Bible in their counseling, but they don't ignore their relationship and a caring relationship, and I talked a lot to them about that. That's up at the still up at the top of my YouTube because I really think that's incredibly important. Don't forget to sign up on Breggin.com, my website, Breggin, my website. Don't forget to sign up on the website for the frequent alerts, which will keep you in touch with all the things I talk about, and it's free. And don't forget the Dr. Breggin Live, Breggin Live at hotmail.com. So you can email me. I have that just for my radio folks, Breggin Live at hotmail.com. There's just so many interesting and exciting things going on. Now, if those of you in my wonderful, wonderful audience are listening for the first or second time and you don't know where this is coming from, today is November 14th, 2018. And this show is live from 4 to 5 p.m. every week on Wednesdays, though it's not always live. Sometimes I do a replay. But it's Wednesdays, 4 to 5 p.m., live on PRN-FM, www.prnfm. And we take callers. We have a wonderful time with callers. And today is going to be a particularly great time for callers. Michael, are you there? You hooked in good?
Yes, Peter, I'm here.
Okay, well, I'm about to come to you. I'm having my friend, my marvelous professional colleague, Michael Cornwall, who is a psychologist, who has a Jungian background, existential background. He holds seminars at Big Sur, and when I hand him over to you, and he writes on Mad in America. But in a minute, Michael, I want you to just sort of elaborate on some of what you do. But we're going to be talking about dreams today, like I advertised on my frequent alert. We're going to talk about dreams, and I think that's really interesting. So call in about anything you think Michael and I would be interested in hearing about. Keep it as relevant to psychosis and dreams and treatment as you can. But you got some other questions that'll go too. But gosh, I'd love to get a conversation going about dreams. And you call in. This is not how you listen to the radio show. You call in to 888-874-4888. From around the world, I believe. Maybe my engineer will correct me, but we get around the world calls. 888-874-4888. Call in and talk to us, especially about dreams. But, you know, we'll be in 15, 20 minutes, somewhere along that line. We'll be taking calls on whatever interests the folks from our audience. And remember also the radio show, if you go to Bregan.com, we have a searchable archive. You can search the past. You could put in Michael's name and Michael Cornwall's name. And it happened so fast you won't think it's happened. But all of a sudden, if you re-look at the list, there will be his shows. It's kind of a funny thing because the search is so fast, you think nothing's happened and you're waiting for it, but it already happened. And it's all up there, anybody you've searched for. Michael Corrigan's another person you could look up. There are just so many wonderful people that we have on the show. Well, I'm going to take a deep breath. I'm still recovering from my trip. I'm still catching up. I can't tell you, folks, how much love there is out there for those of us who are helping people medically with their nutrition and therapeutically or philosophically with the emphasizing the importance of love. One of the ideas I've been elaborating, and it'd be interesting to talk to Michael about it, talk to you in the audience, that not only is love what really heals us, but since we're social creatures and all of our problems basically relate to social issues, that means they're love issues, that basically everything that we call psychiatric disorders, if you dig deep enough, are disorders of love. Now, there's something to think about. It sounds really radical, but it isn't really radical if you look at what almost all religions say. But it's radical for this secular world, and it's radical for the DSM. Oh, God, all the way up to the five. It's radical. But think about it. Think about yourself that way. Maybe have a conversation with us about that along with everything else. That increasingly it seems to me that if you really listen to what's ailing somebody, it's a lack of happy, joyful, caring engagement with life. It's a lack of a loving relationships and probably the presence of not loving relationships and even hateful ones that have affected the person at the present time or since childhood or has led the person to make mistaken choices in work, in hobbies, in relationships, in marriage, and romance that's distorted for the person the idea of love and the possibility of having a loving relationship with the world. Doesn't mean you ignore what's wrong with it. In fact, the more you approach the world in a loving way, the more you'll just see all the stuff that isn't, and the more you will be, want to help the world. I don't think it makes us into Pollyannish fools to think that love is what the world is about, or fails to be about. So that's all for me, Michael. Hi. Any thoughts on my commentary before you? And also, anything more you want to say about yourself or the great people out there listening?
Thank you, Peter. I love that you're talking about love, because that's the core for me too, both in my own life, trying to find the ability to love myself and others around me and receive their love, but also in my work. It's about 40 years now of specializing in being with people in extreme states. That's really the key, is when we're with someone who's suffering in that way or any way, whether it's depression or terror or anxiety, grief, if we're there in a loving way and receiving their emotions and not doing what you and I know what passes for care, the so-called best practices and standards of care that are really so often cold and distant and unloving. I think that's something that can't be talked about enough. And I think there's a real wave coming. You're part of it, and you have been for decades going back. You've always had the heart-centered approach, and some of the trainings I do at Esalen Institute and other places around the country, and this NASOS project that I'm involved with in San Francisco, we're trying to get a sanctuary there for people in extreme states. It's all based on that compassionate connection. And I just remember reading one of Freud's proclamations was actually psychoanalysis is a cure through love. So I think it's very important that we actually use that word. I was thinking a few years ago, Peter, I was at a big conference where I was doing a workshop, and the title of my workshop was Responding to Extreme States with Loving Receptivity. And it was the first time I really kind of took that plunge and was going to use the L word. And I thought, well, I'm going to get some heat from this, because there's a lot of, you know, frontline psychiatrists and psychologists going to be at this. But to my surprise, it was the largest attended workshop of the whole conference. 80 people showed up. It was standing room only. So I don't think love is ever going to be ignored or unrecognized by people. So I'll just start by saying that. And then today I wanted to be with you, because we were going to talk about dreams and working with
Before dreams. We go there, Michael, yeah. I'm sure people listening are saying, hey, what is he doing out in San Francisco with this a place for people with extreme states? Could you tell us more about that before we go on to the dream issues?
Yes, I will. So again, a group of us in San Francisco, led by dear friends, one, Michael Guy Thompson, that had been on your program before, who had been with R.D. Lang, the psychiatrist in London, who had these sanctuaries for people going through extreme states. So Michael and his former partner, Nita Gage, who is with Lang, they're kind of spearheading this project here in San Francisco that we're really, I think, getting close to finding a property and getting funding to open doors on a sanctuary where people can go in without the diagnosis, without medications, if they choose to not have medications. It'll be off the grid, Peter. It won't have any public funding. As we know, anything now that's tied to a mental health diagnosis in the public sector has to have that diagnosis, and almost now the standard of care, any diagnosis means medication. So this is a revolutionary thing that some of us did this work back in the 70s and 80s, and we're trying to revive it here in the Bay Area, and I'm optimistic that that's going to happen. It's called the NASOS Project. If people want to Google that, NASOSproject.com.
Spell that, Michael, would you?
Yeah, NASOS, G-N-O-S-I-S. Knossos project. Knossos means kind of inspired knowledge or some kind of deep understanding. So that's what we're trying to bring. And so the whole focus of this is to have a loving environment where people can come and not be labeled or, stigmatized. So I'm very excited about it, and hopefully it'll bear fruit soon.
I'm so glad. We just need so many more approaches that are drug-free and voluntary, that are based on caring. I mean, not very complicated, caring, drug-free, and voluntary. Keep at it. It's something I've just never had the opportunity or the particular, I never thought it was what I should be doing myself. And we just need a lot of folks to be doing these things. And you're going to be involved. You are involved yourself. That's wonderful. Is it going to be in the San Francisco area?
We're looking for properties in San Francisco. We're involved now with some leaders around the public land trust, where you can get properties and they'll be kind of yours in perpetuity. Part of the problem of all these alternative programs have been, as political tides turn in when they were in mental health systems or even neighborhoods, who don't, have the NIMBYism, not in my backyard. So we're really looking to secure something in San Francisco. Yeah.
Well, good luck. And that's just wonderful. I'm just so glad to hear you're doing it. And if I can do anything to help promote it or something at any time, in the future, I'm there to do that, to have you on the show to talk about it, or to have you come back with the people you're working with, have them back again too. Okay, so
great.
Let's go on then and talk some about dreams and how you got into all of that.
Okay, well, it's pretty connected because my first real entrance into working with my own dreams was back in the day here in San Francisco, when there were actually three of these kind of sanctuaries where people could go through their extreme states without medication. One of them was headed up by a Jungian psychiatrist named John Weir Perry, who opened a place in San Francisco called Diabasis House. And it was open there in San Francisco, funded by the city for several years. And for those of your audience who aren't too familiar with Jung, Carl Jung was Sigmund Freud's disciple. And at some point, after many years with Freud, they had a break where Jung saw that Freud's focus on just the personal unconscious and the kind of the interpersonal world was missing a lot, and Jung had this concept of what he called the collective unconscious, where what we know through literature and all kind of sacred texts that there are these mythic themes, there are archetypal, they call, the different powerful archetypes of the hero and the divine child and the mother and so forth. So throughout time, people have been having dreams and visions and extreme states with these powerful images and emotions. So that was part of the whole thing that John Perry brought to his sanctuary, where people could go in there and go through these processes. And it was like, being in that waking dream. I really think that's what extreme states are. That threshold of consciousness is so thin, any of us, and I believe, go into these extreme states if enough happens to us. Anyway, so John Weir Perry, I met him, and I said, well, that's the guy I want to be in therapy with or analysis with. So because dreams are so central to that Jungian model of therapy, for 4 years I would truck over to San Francisco and with my dreams in hand on 3x5 cards and do this dream work with John Weir Perry, who was that was part of the Jungian analysis. And it's real interesting because that approach to dreams that Perry learned from Jung is really unique. It's not that the therapist or analyst is the expert on the person's dream. It's that the therapist helps elicit and amplify the meaning and especially the emotional content that goes along with the symbolic imagery in the dream. And so maybe I could pass along a sharing that Carl Jung gave to Perry when Perry was there with him in Zurich, that really the only place I've seen it published is something I published on Mad in America called Dreams, Still the Royal Road to the Unconscious. And it's a unique teaching that I think your listeners might be interested in and in considering when they have their next dream. So shall I just go ahead and go through that quickly? So Perry told me when he was there with Carl Jung after World War II, he was there for a couple of years when that Jung Institute was just starting there. He had a unique relationship with Jung because Perry had met Jung back in 1932 when Jung was at Harvard doing a presentation. And so Perry met with Jung every week or two for an hour or so. He wasn't in analysis with Jung. And at one point, Jung said, told John he wanted to pass on a dream teaching to him. And what it was Jung said that for sometimes many months, he'd have this terrifying, repetitive dream, a nightmare of a menacing dragon pursuing him. And when he would have this dream, he would wake up every time, like we often do from nightmares, heart beating, scared and everything. And he just, for the life of him, couldn't understand why this was happening. And being the, I would say, bona fide genius that he was, Jung one day was kind of meditating in this active imagination state, wondering about what this dream was. And he realized that the emotion in that dream, the terror he felt, was the exact emotion that he felt, nothing against mother-in-laws, but it was the exact emotion he felt when his mother-in-law would walk in the room. So there was some terror he had deep in his unconscious of a strong, however the mother-in-law was with him, a strong female figure that had manifested and kind of stirred up this mythological dream for him. And so it was a huge breakthrough. And so what he told John Perry was the key to a dream, when you, whether it's something that dramatic or it could be even just like a situation or a room or a house or a setting, the key to getting a real handle on what dreams are telling us is to look to the emotion in the dream. When you wake up, ask yourself, that emotion I had in that dream, it could be terror, it could be sorrow, it could be joy, it could be anything, whatever the emotion is, look to that emotion in the dream, and then kind of in a reverie, look out and into your real life, your waking life, and try and connect what that emotion in the dream is to a situation or a relationship in your real life. I think that was a dramatic breakthrough he had there, because so often, especially Jungians who like to really focus on imagery, you know, there's not a one-to-one correlation between you dream of a dragon, you're going to see one in real life. But if you have the emotional terror of a dragon, and then when you wake up and you realize, wow, that happens when my mother-in-law walks in the room, that's a real informative gift, I think, because not only does it say what's going on in our real life that is a really powerfully affecting our unconscious, but it shows how our unconscious is responding to it. So if I have a dream, say it could be a very mundane dream. I think a lot of people, we've had these dreams where we were, back in high school, we weren't getting our homework done. So a lot of people have dreams of being in the hallway and can't get the locker open to their, I don't know if you've ever had that dream, but you can't get the locker open, and you're failing and you can't get your books out, and you kind of have, you wake up and go, oh my God, why am I having that dream, that feeling of, failing and being overwhelmed? And even a mundane dream like that, you can go, where in my real life right now do I have that emotion? And sure enough, for me, I can look out and kind of go, oh, it's this situation over here where I'm feeling unsure of myself, or I'm procrastinating, or I'm behind, or I'm, feeling insecure or something. And that gives me information. Oh, well, I need to pay attention to that. you know, my psyche is helping me kind of be alert that there is something that I'm emotionally experiencing in my real life that is coming up in my dreams. So I'll kind of stop there, but that's that Jungian approach. I think people could try it when they wake up in the morning, if they can pinpoint an emotion or emotions in a dream and just say, hey, I wonder where in my real life that emotion exists.
Yeah, I like it. It's very practical. I've actually not thought of it that way. I would tend to get more into, you know, what is happening in your life that this reflects on. What are you struggling with in your life that this reflects on? I tend to get heady or intellectual maybe. And this is a direct emotional where you're just saying, you know, what is the emotion? I might ask the person, might have asked the person, asked Jung, well, who does the dragon remind you of? Or do you feel like there's a dragon in your life? And maybe he wouldn't have gotten to the same place as asking himself, where do I have this emotion?
That's a really good point. That's a great point because before I started employing this method with people, I'd say, well, just like you said, you know, where does the dragon remind you? But because it's not really plugged into the emotion, they don't have the conscious awareness of it. But if they can kind of drop down, oh, in fact, I do this often with people in therapy, like kind of drop down into that emotion in the dream, and they'll go, I'm not getting anything. And also they go, oh, yeah, that's where it's in this relationship with this person or that person.
One of the things that strikes me is, I guess it suggests that he didn't kind of realize at the time that his mother-in-law was frightening him in some level, only when he thought about the dream and somehow that connected him and he realized that. Sounds like he didn't kind of sense it at the time. Is that
right,
the implication?
And I think yeah, it is. And I think that's something that kind of speaks to, I'd say, the reality that we, you know, these so-called, you know, depth psychologists of the Freudians and the Jungians, you know, they're really saying that our conscious ego, our conscious waking state is kind of floating on a huge unconscious sea of personal unconsciousness and even this collective unconsciousness where these mythic forces are. So I think that's part of, I think, what's missing these days in, you know, such brief therapy. I have people come to see me who have been in a term of, you know, 6 or 7 sessions through their health plan of brief therapy or solution-focused therapy or CBT and problem-solving. I mean, that's all good. It can be really helpful. But a lot of times, you know, there's a lot more going on in our life than can be resolved in kind of a cognitive behavioral way, because I think we really do have this deep unconscious life.
How much emphasis do you put on a collective unconsciousness? I don't do anything much with that. I'm trying to think if I do anything with that. I mean, I certainly not in any way that I can pinpoint do I think of myself as having a collective unconscious. So educate me and educate all my audience, many of whom are probably saying, Peter, what's the matter with you? You don't have a collective unconscious.
Well, I think the collective unconscious, again, is one of those terms, I think, trying to point to this, you know, it could be called transpersonal or kind of a universal inheritance we all have, where the deep, almost impersonal, still there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hello? Okay, sorry, I heard a blip.
I did too, but no, we're fine.
Okay, so when we have dreams or even in our waking life, where things are numinous, where they're full of kind of an uncanny or larger than life power, like, you know, Jung dreaming of the dragon, or a person having a dream of love and romance, and it's so fascinating and awesome. I think the collective unconscious has that kind of human birthright quality to it, that, you know, we're all on this planet, we've all been raised up with the sun and the moon and the water and people and animals, but when something has, and, you know, we see it in art, we hear it in music, when we have an emotional resonance to something that kind of makes our jaw drop, I think those are all the things that are in the collective unconscious. So kind of a popular thing that was, I think, interesting when the Star Wars movies first started coming out, and the guy Lucas who put those together said, you know, he was really interested in what Joseph Campbell was talking about the myths, all those myths, those mythic figures of the hero, of the maiden, of the villain, of good and evil, life, death. So I think the collective unconscious is that kind of dramatic, mythic source that's under, you know, me dreaming about I'm at school and can't get in my locker. That's kind of more of the personal unconscious. But if I was having that dream and down the hallway came a shining, beautiful woman who said, I will help you open your locker. See, that would be from the collective unconscious, or an archetypal figure.
Tell me about working with people who are labeled schizophrenic. In our conversation together before the show, you mentioned that often psychiatrists, therapists teach, you know, don't do dream interpretation with very disturbed people, probably yeah. because there's some fear of just opening the unconscious even more to dominate. But I can... I won't even say another word about it. Tell us about your experience.
Okay, well, that was pretty dramatic for me, because after that sanctuary I worked at that was similar to Diapasis, there was another one in the East Bay called I Ward. It was there for about 8 years. I was there for about 4 years, where people could go through these processes without medication. And there you would see, you know, when people are in these extreme states, really dramatic, you know, being, I would say, possessed by these archetypal collective unconscious forces. You know, a young woman in an ecstatic transport, one day heavenly, and then the next day she's, you know, the daughter of the devil and all grimacing and stuff. So that was like the waking dream. But when that closed, because I was so, you know, involved in that level of people's experience, I was working in a clinic, and got transferred there, and I started being, you know, as I have all these decades, seeing people in these extreme states, and especially for people who didn't go through that kind of real dramatic upheaval, where, you know, all that imagery and stuff was happening. And one guy in particular, Peter, who had actually been on I Ward, I'd worked with him on I Ward for about several months, and he was one who, remember, they used to call that awful term hebephrenic, schizophrenic.
Oh, my God, you know, yes, yeah.
You know, the flat affect, they're hopeless, they're not even thinking in there, nothing's going on. Well, that guy presented like that. He wasn't flamboyant, he wasn't florid, he was just a flat face, nothing going on, but a huge trauma and stuff had happened in his life that has sent him into this extreme state. Well, when he gets out of the ward closes, then he starts seeing me in the clinic. For some reason, I just had this sense. No, I believe there's a lot going on in there. So I asked him, to the consternation of my clinical supervisor, to start seeing if he could bring me dreams in. And, you know, that's like a huge taboo. Then my clinical supervisor, you know, Michael, this is, you know, we do not do dream work with people with this diagnosis. Well, you know, so I did it anyway. But I had the blessing of John Weir Perry at the time. He said, I've never done that. He'd never worked with people so-called with these chronic diagnoses. So lo and behold, it's just like, you know, that if you build it, they will come. I asked him, I said, if, you know, and he was really disorganized. He was like in a fugue state most of the time. I said, you know, if you have dreams, would you come tell me your dreams? Well, the next, I saw him a couple times a week. The next time I saw him, he came in, he goes, I had a dream. So he tells me this dream. So he starts telling me these dreams, and I saw him for a year and a half or more after that, and every time I saw him, Peter, he had a dream, but these dreams were so powerful, and they were so transformative. I will just give an example of one that he had repetitively. He'd say, here I am. I'm racing up and down in front of my parents' house on a red motorcycle, and my mother comes up and says, get off that motorcycle. Come up here on the porch, and she makes me get on a little tricycle, and I'm on a little tricycle. So he had that dream several times, and he told me, being again, you know, not playing by the rules, I said, well, why don't we walk down to the, there was a motorcycle dealership nearby. We walked down to the motorcycle dealership, and there was a big red Honda motorcycle there. And I said, do you want to get up on it? And the guys working there kind of going, is he all right? I'm going, yeah. And so he gets up on the motorcycle. You know, he has a big motorcycle there, all that power and everything. And so that was a turning point. After that, that dream shifted. And then over the time, there was another series of dreams, a whole months full of dreams of where a lot of rage and anger came up. Then a whole dream, a series of grief. So anyway, I did that dream work with him. And it was, I believe it was the not only the turning point, but the key to his coming out of that. Last I saw him, he was married. He had a child. He had a job. Peter, this is a guy that was headed for the state hospital forever.
That's amazing. That's amazing. What a wonderful story.
Yeah.
What a wonderful story. Had he been at all in a state hospital that would drive him into that kind of condition? You know, the so-called hebephrenia, folks, was like he was supposed to become a simpleton, you know,
right.
Quote, a form of schizophrenia where you were a simpleton and you had a paucity. That was one great word there. Paucity of thinking.
Paucity.
Feeling.
Right.
And my sense of it was that, you know, this could happen to anybody in a state mental hospital. I mean, where everything was a paucity and everything was pushing you toward a state like that.
Yeah.
But for him, it was trauma outside the hospital.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because there was a percentage of people who came to these sanctuaries like IWARD and Diabasis who had that presentation of the flat affect, none of the dramatic florid stuff going on, and he was one of them. And I think, again, in terms of what we know about the untruths of the biomedical model, he didn't have some biogenetic ticking time bomb that was just waiting to go off when he reached a certain age, because Peter, this young guy had no previous so-called psychosis or extreme states. He was in college. He was a track star. He had a girlfriend. He had a part-time job. He had a car. All that was going for him. But in his family, there was a lot of pain. There was a lot of intergenerational trauma. The family were immigrants. They'd lived in a war zone. So all that was in there. But he was really doing pretty well. And then one day, he was in the southern part of the state, succeeding in all that. He got a phone call from his mother saying, you need to come home. You need to give all this up. Your father's coming back from overseas, and you need to be here and take care of some stuff. I won't go into the details. So it was demanded of him that he give up everything. And instead of him going, you know, I'm not going to do that. This is my life. It's too important. He just said, okay. And at that point, he just shut down. So he wasn't someone who'd been in a state hospital. He was a highly functioning young 18-year-old person who got overwhelmed emotionally and already.
Yeah.
You
found a way to communicate with him. You found a way that he was willing to communicate with you. And that changed, that helped, opened up his life again for him. That's a wonderful, wonderful story. Folks, the call-in number again is 888-874-5433. 4888. Mike, I'm going to take a caller. I wonder if she talked to you when you were on before, because Sarah from California is a real friend of me and the show now. Hi, Sarah, you there?
Hi, Dr. Braden, I sure am. How are you both doing?
Hi, good.
We're doing really great. You know, I had a wonderful time at the Pam Popper conference that I co-sponsor. Did you ever call in before when Michael was on?
I believe so.
Yeah, that's what I remembered. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So what's up now, Sarah? What's doing with you?
Well, it's been interesting to hear your discussion about the dreams and how understanding their meaning can help you move forward. When I was in grad school, I quit ECT against medical advice. I moved out of the abusive group home against all advice. I just suddenly took life by the reins, but I kept having this really bizarre dream that I was, any conversation I was in, suddenly I'd be chewing gum and the gum would fill my mouth and I'd be pulling the gum out of my mouth and all my teeth would come with it. And I couldn't help figure out what on earth it meant. And I mean, I had this dream easily more than 20 times over a period of 18 months. And finally, I was so tired of it, I looked up what it could possibly mean. And it was interesting. They said that if you have dreams of your teeth falling out or your teeth getting loose, it means that you're worried that people will find out who you really are. And that was really profound to me because I had been told for almost 18 years that I was nobody and that all I was good for was living in a state hospital or an institution and having PCP for the rest of my life. And suddenly I was in graduate school and I was doing real research and I was working as a professor and assistant, graduate assistant, and actually working and spreading this voice about the realities of psychiatric medication and the realities of diagnosing people who've experienced such nasty traumas and just who've had extreme states. It's been fascinating to me as I'm coming into this new role as an advocate instead of a victim.
Your voice got a little hard to hear, Sarah. And are you outside? It sounds like there's wind in the microphone.
Sorry, let me get inside. Yes.
Okay. You know, it's funny. When you're outside, you don't realize how the sounds get picked up, especially wind gets picked up. It's been pretty windy in California. Are you anywhere near the fires?
I am south of the fires. I live in San Diego, and the fires have been in the LA area.
Okay. Now, Sarah, we're going to be talking. We've nailed down a date for you to be my literal guest, right?
Yeah, I'm really excited about that.
December 5th, folks. Sarah's going to be the guest. She goes from being wonderful audience to being wonderful guest. We've never met, and we've had no relationship, really not much emailing or anything outside the show, just a little bit. But she is such a staunch supporter and has such an amazing story to tell that I think it's just going to be amazing to have her make the move from caller to full-blown guest on December 5th. I'm really looking forward to it. Do you have any other experience with dreams that you wanted to share?
Well, for me, when I was on psychiatric medication, my dreams were more vivid than my reality when I was awake And so that became extremely problematic because the dreams were always violent and just really creepy, scary. And I don't even watch rated R movies or like TV shows with any kind of violence. And these dreams would just be very graphic and completely, they would draw me in. And then when I'd wake up, it was like I couldn't separate between what I had just experienced in my dream and what I was experiencing in real life, because my brain was so fogged by the Haldol and the Seroquel. And so my family would always be telling me, you know, well, it was just a dream, Sarah. And I'm like, oh, I understand that logically, but my reality is so fogged that I couldn't, it was very difficult to set aside the emotion that the dream evoked and be able to just continue with that day.
Sarah, the connection is still not the best. I want you to stay on because we can hear you and you're very important, but it's a little tinny almost like I could hear voices in the background. I don't know if there's and usually your calls are crystal clear.
Well, my problem is I'm not the doctor's office.
I kept so you on hold too long, huh?
That's okay. Well, I'll let you go because I know so many other people are interested in joining this conversation.
No, I'm very interested in having you stay on. If you maybe I should let you go for your sake, Michael. Thoughts about violence and dreams and anything that you wanted to add here?
Well, it's great to hear from you, Sarah, and I'm looking forward to hearing you on Peter's show on December 5th. I don't know what to say about your dreams. Again, I think it's important, I think, for us to find our own meaning in our own dreams. And I think other people can kind of help us seek that out. But I just say one thing, and maybe Peter can comment on that. From what I've been reading for a long time, a lot of the meds that are given, whether they're heavy psychotropic meds or sleep meds or anti-anxiety meds, they really interfere with that natural 90-minute sleep cycle that with the dream rapid eye movement dream sleep. And so I think it's real tragic at times that because dreams are so important and sleep is so important that it gets disrupted by the medications that are given, and there's no doubt in my mind that if we don't dream, if we don't get that kind of therapeutic experience of processing all that emotion in our dreams in a way that's natural, that it really sets us up for difficulty.
The strange thing is, in the 3 years that I've been off of medications, I no longer dream. It's just really bizarre.
I suspect that all people dream, but a lot of us don't remember them.
Yeah.
What do you think, Michael?
Well, I think, yes, we do dream. That's kind of built in biologically that at the end of that 90-minute sleep cycle, there is the rapid eye movement. Often people, I hear a lot from people, well, I don't dream, but actually it's because they're not remembering their dreams. Kind of a simple thing that I found that works for most people, if you just take a pad and paper and set it by the bedside and say, if I do have a dream, maybe my unconscious will help me remember it and I can write it down. Time and time again, I've heard people say, I never dream or I never remember my dreams. If they do that, it's almost like it's honoring the unconscious or something. And you might try that.
I'll have to work on that.
Michael, do you find that people can change their dreams? I have encouraged on occasion my clients who are having dreams that are just overwhelming them in addition to the other stuff we do talking about it, I tend to treat dreams like sort of broken poetry and poems and what can we get from them, to actually think before they go to sleep about dreaming something less frightening, to think about having a peaceful dream. Have you ever worked with trying to help people modify their dreams?
Not that quite that directly, but I think, again, because I think dreams are so first and foremost emotional experience that get symbolized in the imagery and the language in dreams, that what we can do to calm ourselves before we go to sleep, and it may take, even though if you take an hour, if a person's having quite a few nightmares, take an hour or so before to kind of unwind and don't watch TV and do some breathing and relaxing and kind of nurturing oneself. I think that can help kind of set the stage for less anxiety. But even those terrifying dreams, I think, are important that when we have them, the next time we remember them, we can look at what's the source of the emotion in our life. Because in my experience, we really don't have those kind of terrifying dreams unless there is something to be terrified or has been something to be terrified. I mean, it's classic for people who have PTSD to have recurrent nightmares. And I think kind of bringing that into awareness and talking and having that loving care, you know, loving therapy to where someone can feel safe, that just translates back into the unconscious. Okay, I'm feeling safer and safer in my real world. Then our sleep life will reflect that.
Good. Makes a lot of sense. Way back, about the second year that Prozac was out, there was a 12-year-old boy that's described in a study. No one ever paid any attention to it, but it was a study out of Yale, and this boy was in a controlled clinical trial, and he started having nightmares about going to school and it's being a dangerous place, and then he started to have nightmares about going to school and killing people. And then when he started to wake up, he was losing track of reality. Was this real or unreal? And they broke the double blind on the study, and he was on the Prozac. And all this took place before any major school shooting. So he wasn't copycatting Columbine. This is probably I imagine he was a patient probably about 1989, 1990. So the answer to your earlier question is, of course, many drugs distort. All drugs, psychoactive drugs, probably disrupt sleep. I'm sure they all must, whether we can tell or not. And thinking about violence, that here is something about Prozac. My gosh, I mean, could it be that specific that it gets people into thinking, young people into thinking about mass violence in regard to their schools. But that was out of the blue. I've never seen anybody but me discuss it. It's a sort of bad news. Let me grab a call. And Sarah, Sarah is still on. Sarah, but I'm going to go to Sue now in Nashville. You can hang on, Sarah. I trust you. Sue in Nashville, we have just a few minutes to the show. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Thank you. Nice to.
Well, you're welcome.
Hi. Hi.
I'm so sorry I came in late during this because I forgot about the time change. We're in Nashville. But dreams, I think my mother always thought they meant something. And I don't know if that's what you're discussing or is it medication and dreams. But I do dream quite a bit, have vivid dreams, and they're wonderful and can be scary. And I've noticed lately my son is going through schizophrenia, and it's been heart-wrenching and heartbreaking. He's not on medication. He just wants to be left alone. And I notice I dream a lot about him being young. And I think it's maybe because I realize there's things I could have done differently in his youth. I don't know if that means anything. Does it mean anything?
Michael, go ahead.
Hi, Sue. Thanks for calling. Well, again, I couldn't answer that question for you, but it sounds like you're asking yourself that question about the meaning of your dreams of your son being young. And again, you might have missed part of the show where I was talking about how the emotion that we experience in a dream can be important to look at when we wake up. So I don't know what emotional response you have in those dreams of your son, if it's happiness or sorrow or
what it is.
Kind of a mix of all. My husband always calls them, oh, you're having an anxiety dream. And I think what we fall asleep on emotionally does come out in our dreams.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I think that's really true. Are you imagining better times with your son or worse times? Or would you rather not discuss it?
Oh, no, that's fine. It's a mix of the two. Sometimes he dies or he's going to die in my dream, and it just wakes me up. So it's a mix of both. I think it's all part of healing. It's been a grieving process, having to accept where he's at. So, yeah.
Is there anybody, have you thought about trying to find someone, a therapist of some kind that you and your son could both go to and talk, and maybe other members of the family? We know that that one of the very, well, how old is your son, may I ask?
He's 25. It's been 5 years since he broke.
Is he living at home with you?
No, he's homeless most of the time.
Is there any chance that you could develop some relationship with him around a professional counselor where you guys could talk about your relationship and mending it, and not about the problems in it, but the positives in it? We just know that if you can have improved positive communication in a family, that the member who is suffering the most could help heal.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. If we could get him there, it would be lovely. But he just refuses. He had some bad experiences with psych hospitals.
So, yeah. It would have to be a counselor who wasn't going to give drugs. Marriage and family counselor kind of person, probably. Oh, my God. It's on top of us. I lost track of time. Sue, thanks for being on the air. And Sarah, thank you for being there. And Michael Cornwall, you're just so full of wisdom and kindness. It's always a pleasure to have you on the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour, a genuine pleasure.
Thank you, Peter. I love being with you.
And thanks, my wonderful audience. Thanks for calling in. And we'll be seeing you a week from today, 4 to 5 p.m. live on www.prnfm, New York time. Bye-bye.